This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast show on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Giles Tremlett, author of the book The International Brigades, Fascism, Freedom, and the Spanish Civil War. Giles, welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, thank you very much, and greetings from Spain.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I'm a historian and a journalist. I'm British born, as I'm sure your listeners will tell from my accent, but I'm also a Spanish national, and I've spent the last 30 years here in Spain, mostly writing about Spain, either in newspapers, particularly The Guardian and The Economist, or as a historian in a series of books in which I've covered from the 15th century onwards. But this book is very much about the 20th century and a subject that's really very alive today. The Spaniards still haven't really come to terms with the Civil War of the 1930s and with the dictatorship that followed that.
I was thinking that comes across very well in the beginning of your book when you describe meeting some of the last survivors who had served in the International Brigades. What was it that led you to write the book? Was it that sense that these people were passing, or were you motivated by other interests as well?
Well, I think several things combined. One is that these people were really just about to die out. I start off my book with a character called Virgilio Fernández del Real, who was a Mexican, came to stay with me for a while a couple of years ago, and who sadly passed away shortly after that, aged 100. And the other brigaders now have also all died, as far as we know. So in that sense, I felt it was time to write their history. But also for anyone who's been who's interested in the Spanish Civil War, who's interested in the 20th century history of Spain, the International Brigades was such an amazing phenomenon at the time and are so prominent in people's minds that it's really something that, you know, I felt I had to, I wouldn't say get out of the way, but it's something I had to know fully about before I could go on any further. So in many ways, this has been an indulgence because it's something I've wanted to do for a very long time. But also it was an opportunity to write what I hope for the moment anyway is the let's call it the definitive current history, because of course it can always be improved on by someone else later on. But anyway, a history of a remarkable phenomenon, a history that nobody's written for about 30 or 40 years, and was badly in need of updating, and could be done very well thanks to the amount of archive material that's now open.
One of the things I was especially fascinated by as I read your book was the sheer diversity of the international brigades that you capture. I mean, the diversity was very well known. You read about it in works like Orwell's famous memoir of the Spanish Civil War. But you really do capture that sense of the diversity throughout the war, all these different people and the causes they served. I was wondering if you could start us off by talking a bit about what were the international brigades and what was it that led to their involvement at the very start of the Spanish Civil War? What was going on in Spain, and why did these people from very different places, very different backgrounds, initially decide to join this conflict against this military uprising?
Okay, so I think to set the scene, we have to remember that we're in 1930s Europe. There's a historian called Piers Brendan who's written a book called The Dark Valley, which I think the title itself sort of sums up very nicely the state of Europe in the 1930s, post the First World War, post the great crash of the 1920s, in turmoil and disarray, and with fascism on the march through much of Europe, with democracies falling, fairly recent democracies falling and going over to authoritarian governments, with communism having appeared really quite recently, and a state of sort of tension in which I think everybody was, well, not everybody, but a lot of people were expecting another world war. And the first war obviously was traumatic enough. So when in Spain in 1936, there's an uprising by reactionary generals led by Francisco Franco, who will become the dictator later on, to overthrow Spain's very short-lived experiment with democracy. It had only been a democracy for 6 years. Many people saw in what was happening a threat to democracy, but also an expansion of the broader world of fascism and its allies. And especially since Franco was supported by Hitler and by Mussolini, who sent troops, sent aeroplanes, sent pilots, and were a very important part of his war machine. So there was a feeling that this democracy had to be defended. There was also a feeling that actually Spain was the only place where you could go and fight fascism. And so from the very beginning in July 1936, when the fighting starts with a failed coup, basically, lots of international volunteers appear, and some are already here in Spain. There's a remarkable event that's meant to take place, meant to start on exactly the same day that the Civil War starts, which is known as the People's Olympiad in Barcelona. This was a sort of rival Olympic Games to the games that Hitler was about to hold in Berlin, which were meant to be a sort of massive propaganda exercise for the Nazis and for the Aryan race. And so this was an opportunity to do something. And as Europe was also actually full of political exiles from Germany, from Italy, from other places, from authoritarian regimes in Poland and Hungary and other places, well, very quickly, a lot of people turned up just as volunteers, just coming on their own and looking for something to join. What happens after a few months in October of 1936 is that rather than just being allowed to join random militia units, which are the ones that were set up to fight Franco, who took most of the established army with him, the international brigades per se were set up as an international unit, a place where volunteer fighters could go. And it was organized basically by Comintern, by the International Communist Organization. But its spirit was a popular front spirit. In other words, it was, you know, very broad left, like the government in Spain itself, or indeed the government in France at that time. And then once it was organized, well, it was, you know, a lot more people came together, but very particularly this crowd of international volunteers appeared from all parts of the world, from more than 60 countries of the time, which in today's terms is more than 80 countries today. And so you have this remarkable army of 35,000 men and women who speak a couple of dozen languages, who come from all over the world, who mostly are not trained soldiers, but who nevertheless will be employed as shock troops during the war, and who become a sort of focus of attention for the rest of the world as it looks on. The Spanish Civil War is best sort of understood in terms of its the attention it garnered as sort of being the Vietnam War of the moment. It's the war that everybody was watching. And the international brigades gave many people a sort of a prism that they could look through, because there were people of their own nationality, of their own country, fighting in that war, including 2,800 Americans from the mostly in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, including a very high percentage of Jews, about 10% altogether. And that's interesting, gives us a story of the first armed Jewish resistance to fascism. In the American Brigade, in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, we have the first Black Americans who are allowed to command white troops, because in segregated America, that wasn't possible. Was only possible in the International Brigades, and it wouldn't be possible in World War II in the American Armed Forces. So lots of things are going on, and there's a massive amount of ideological turmoil just on the left in Spain itself. Socialists, communists, anarchists, Trotskyists were all supposedly fighting together, but sometimes at one another's throat. So broadly speaking, this is a sort of, it's like jamming the whole of Europe's problems into one small jar and then sort of setting fire to it.
that is a very good analogy.
That's what's happening in Spain. And really it's that, you know, for many historians, you know, it's the first battle of World War II. That's the other way to say it.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a bit upon the how it was that people got to Spain, because as you describe it, it's, you know, you mentioned how the Comintern was very heavily involved in recruiting. You also describe unions, and yet when you detail the stories in the book, and yours is a book that is just chock full of stories, you talk about how for many of them it was in a sense of they were recruited somewhere and transported as a body. Oftentimes they made their way individually or as collections of friends or in ones and twos to make their way individually to Spain to join this cause. Was there any sort of patterns or common congregation points? How did people oftentimes with zero knowledge of Spain or Spanish end up, you know, being able to find their way to the right place and to, you know, be able to formally join the cause?
Well, I mean, to begin with, it was pure chaos. People turned up as they could. There are stories of people arriving by bicycle or stowing away on ships or basically walking to Spain. So, you know, some people it took weeks to get here. There are stories of people cycling from Denmark or coming from Poland and having to cross rivers and sort of hitch rides on carts and things like that. Once we get a formal form of organization from the Comintern, well, that changes. There's a sort of, there are a few agreed meeting places in Paris, in Marseille, in France, and then there's an established way of getting there, which is mostly by train, sometimes by boat. And most volunteers remember that this sort of remarkable trip where they are cheered as they go along each tiny train station they had to stop at, and there are crowds of peasants throwing food at them or offering them wine and cheering them on. That's before the frontier is cut, because the rest of Europe and the United States decided that foreign volunteers shouldn't be allowed into Spain. And at that stage, the borders were cut off. They were patrolled by a sort of international force, and people had to sneak over the Pyrenean mountains at night. And there are some magnificent descriptions of, you know, making it to the top of the mountain at daybreak and seeing the whole of Spain lying beneath your feet.
Now, what you describe over the course of the book is sort of an evolution of not just the war, but the experience of the international brigades. I was wondering if you could explain what their contribution was at the very beginning. Were they able to make an immediate impact? Was there any awareness of the Republican leadership of any of the value of it? Or at what point do they start making a noticeable contribution to the course of the war?
Well, they start making a noticeable contribution from the very beginning. And I'm talking now about the international brigades as a formal unit. So they're formed in October, early in November. They're very poorly trained, very poorly armed, but they are rushed to Madrid, which is about to fall to Franco's forces, to try and stop that from happening. And they're remarkably effective. Everybody expects Madrid to fall. In fact, Madrid doesn't fall at all. It survives another 2 years. And in those first few crucial battles, even though the international brigades are very rough and ready soldiers, they've had, you know, very little training, their guns jam, they don't really know what they're doing. They're actually better than some of the Spanish militia units. And so they are hailed almost immediately as the saviors of Madrid. That's partly propaganda, and it's only partially true, but it certainly is true. They're part of this force that saves Madrid. They're not all of it by any means, and there are lots of Spaniards, obviously, fighting as well. But yes, they're remarkably effective. Right from the beginning. In fact, I think their most effective moments are over those first months or the first year of their existence, where they go into battle often sort of naively convinced that as individuals, and this is a narrative history, so I'm telling lots of individual stories, and they are, you know, naively convinced that their sort of ideological righteousness will allow them to win and possibly protect them from bullets coming from the other side, which is tragic and explains why so many of them died, because you know, one in five died in Spain, and another one in five were wounded or injured, and another unknown number went missing. So, you know, it was a real sacrifice in that sense.
Now, the title of your book is The International Brigades, and you refer to them as brigades. But one of the things that your book makes clear is that thinking of them as a brigade, as a formal military unit with all of the, you know, regimentation, organization that implies, is a misnomer. It's far more chaotic. It's far more fractured. And I found it fascinating because as you explain it, it really does reflect that point that you make early in the book, that the only thing that united all these people was their shared anti-fascism. That you're talking about groups that, you know, but for the fact they were fighting the fascists, might have been fighting each other.
Indeed. One of the characters who appears in the book is George Orwell, and he's there not so much, not because he joins the International Brigade. He doesn't. He goes to Spain. He comes to Spain and fights, but joins a sort of rival militia group that's Trotskyist, that's not liked by the Communist Party, and famously writes Homage to Catalunya when he finds himself in a moment in Barcelona when these two sides, the Trotskyists and the Communists, are shooting at one another. And bizarrely, George Orwell had actually gone to Barcelona because he was fed up with the group he was in, and he wanted to join the International Brigades. And had he arrived a month earlier and been able to join the brigades, well, he probably would have been sitting on the opposite roof, pointing his gun in the opposite direction. So that's the Orwell experience is part of what we know about the Spanish Civil War, about the infighting on the Republican side, and that was very damaging. It was very, very damaging to their war effort, and it made it very difficult to coordinate everything. That said, within the brigades, there was a certain amount of paranoia. But mostly at the top, amongst those who were beginning to live Stalinism in a very sort of direct senior communist sort of a way. But at a lower level, it was simply, you know, a group of people, mostly working class. I mean, we know about the poets and the writers, but really mostly working class, very varied opinions, fighting together, shoulder to shoulder, and for most of them as individuals, it's a remarkable experience. As a phenomenon, it was very strange for observers too, who tried to get their head around the idea of this sort of transnational army when there'd last been a massive volunteer army like this, and the only people at the time they could compare with were the Crusades from the early Middle Ages. Nowadays, you might point to ISIS, for example, or Al-Qaeda, and say, well, that's a sort of transnational volunteer army. But at the time, it was remarkable. Funny enough, I was reading Hannah Arendt the other day on totalitarianism, and there they were. They appear in there as well, and she's saying, no, The international brigades were quite frightening for a lot of governments because precisely because they were international, they didn't fit any sort of easy category. And as a result, governments in liberal democracies didn't know whether to treat them as a good thing or a bad thing, whether they were, you know, defending democracy or whether they were a threat to democracy.
You describe how over time, the groups oftentimes gained individual reputations, that people began to assume things about certain national groups and how they began to assume certain things about ideological groups. And here I'm thinking in particular about the anarchists, who, as you describe it, as you note in your book several times, quickly, you know, became, you know, viewed very skeptically because they're being anarchists, they you know, had issues with military discipline. They weren't seen as very reliable. How did all that play out within the brigades, and how did that and how was that defined by their action on the battlefield?
Well, I mean, it's almost comical at some stages because it's not just the anarchists; it's, you know, a huge number of volunteers consider themselves to be libertarians. and they don't want to receive instructions. They don't want orders. They don't want someone to command them. And all those things, unfortunately, are necessary in armies. And you see people, having trouble with getting their heads around this particular idea. You know, they're writing in their diary saying, you know, I didn't come here to be bossed around by some, you know, by some officer. You know, that's what our enemy does. That's the sort of, you know, that's the manager against the worker, or the foreman against the workers. That's not, you know, that's not the kind of war I signed up for. Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, that's the kind of war everyone signs up for, because you know, if there isn't military discipline and command and things like that, you're a fairly useless military unit. And so within the brigades, you know, heads had to be banged together. People really had to be, you know, forced into obeying or observing some kind of discipline. And there were anarchists in the brigade, especially amongst the Italians. But there were also anarchist units out in the Republican Army, and some brigaders actually left the International Brigades to go and join those anarchist units, which were sometimes good, but often unreliable for the very same reasons that I've just pointed out. So you know, it was a very hard thing to do to come to fight for freedom, and the first thing you have to do is give up your personal freedom, and that's what joining an army is. And the personal freedom that you give up is not just, you know, having to obey orders. It's also, you can't leave. If you leave, you're a deserter. And, you know, you've signed up to an army, and deserters get shot. And in some cases in the international brigades, deserters did get shot.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That was another of the themes that I was seeing over the course of the book, which is how, as the war goes on, there is a, for lack of a better word, regularization that takes place, that over time you have discipline increasingly asserting itself. You have a greater degree of centralization. I was thinking also as well in how you described the role of women, how at the very beginning with the coup and you had the People's Olympiad there, you had a lot of women athletes and journalists who were eager to join. They weren't just joining to serve in traditional women's roles. They were there to fight, and how over time, you know, as the war continued, you began to see that greater control asserted. A lot of those women lost those roles, and they began to become more of the traditional roles. But as you described, women were still very prevalent in among the ranks of the international brigaders in the way that they had not been in previous wars.
Yes, well, right to begin with, you know, anybody was welcome who wanted to, you know, pick up a weapon and defend the Republic. And there were lots of foreign women who wanted to do that. Especially those who were already living in Barcelona or in Madrid. And so the first British fighter to lose her life, or to lose a life in Spain, is an artist, Felicia Brown, who dies when she goes on a behind-the-lines mission before the brigades have even been formed. This is in the early days. There's a famous Dutch machine gunner called Fanny Schoonheit, who, you know, knew how to shoot when most people who were joining the militias didn't actually know how to shoot. She came from a sort of middle-class Dutch background and had been taught to shoot as a sport. And so to begin with, you do get these remarkable women going into the front line, fighting, dying. And in fact, many of the sort of most iconic images of the Spanish Civil War are of women bearing arms. There are some marvelous photographs. But what actually happens is that within about 6 months, the Republican side has decided it doesn't want women in the front line. And so they're all withdrawn. And by the time the brigades are formed and functioning, that means that the women who join them are largely working as or as doctors and or nurses, or in sort of what we might call support roles. So there's one of the few who makes it to the front is an American woman, Evelyn Hutchins, who famously drives trucks and ambulances too, I think. But otherwise, they're mostly nurses like Celaria Key, who was a Black American nurse, the only Black American nurse. But still, there are hundreds of them. There's people are still counting the international brigades. We don't know exact numbers, but between 800 and 1,000 women are there and play their part.
You describe as a factor in how they eventually were, you know, pulled out of those combat roles, a lot of traditional attitudes, even among the Spanish Republicans. And that gets to another aspect of your book that I thought was very interesting, which was the attitude of many of the brigaders towards their Spanish Republican comrades. As you describe, that they weren't always too happy with the people that they were ostensibly fighting for, that they oftentimes got very frustrated at the fact that they wanted to fight a particular type of war, and they found that the Spanish Republicans were fighting a very Republican type of war. I was wondering if you perhaps elaborate upon some of those attitudes that developed it and how maybe their views of the what they were fighting for in terms of Spain changed over time.
Well, I mean, there's a massive cultural shock going on, obviously, for all the volunteers. It's the 1930s. Most people haven't traveled in their lives outside their own country. So they start off with this sort of dual cultural shock. One is that they're in Spain, a country where they don't speak the language, where they don't understand the mores. But also they're with a group of, you know, fellow volunteers who are from all over the world whose cultures they also don't necessarily understand. So to begin with, there's lots of sort of complaining about the fact that, you know, Spaniards, for example, don't want to fight at night. They want to go home and, you know, tuck their children into bed and have supper with their wives and, you know, and then come back in the morning. And this, you know, annoys the volunteers. But fortunately, the other side is actually doing the same to begin with. So we have this rather sort of, again, slightly comical situation of, you know, this war that's fought at, from breakfast until supper time. But, you know, but nothing after that. It's rather like the British breaking for tea at 5 p.m. It always stuns other people when it happens. In terms of who they were defending, I think actually that overall, I mean, there was a lot of surprises. One was that Spaniards were so poor. So you got a lot of people coming from, say, Britain who thought they were poor because they were working class. And they got to Spain where, you know, some people were, if they had, you know, two cooking pots, that was, you know, that was a good load of possessions to have. And they were amazed by the poverty. But I think overall, I think they were very happy to be fighting for the Republic. They were very happy to be fighting for Spaniards, and in fact, you know, in the end, the international brigades have to leave before the war is over, and there's great sadness that they feel that they've actually abandoned Spaniards who they've come to come to love rather dearly. I mean, you know, there's some annoyance because the sort of Northern Europeans and Americans, you know, see all these beautiful Spanish girls and don't know how to talk to them and get very annoyed because the Italians and the Cubans are really good at it. that's just cultural.
Now, you mentioned that the international brigades have their greatest impact early in the war. How does the war play out for them? And at what point do you start to see the growing awareness that the war is not going to end well for their side?
So I think we'd have to divide the war into a few stages, perhaps three or four stages. So to begin with, as far as the brigades are concerned, it's all about saving Madrid. So there's the battle in Madrid itself to stop the city being overrun. And then there are attempts by the Franco side to sort of encircle the city with maneuvers, which are actually quite a, you know, 10, 15, 20 miles away or further. And you get famous battles, the Battle of Jarama, which some people might know from a song about the Valley of the Jarama. So there are lots of battles around Madrid. And the international brigades perform incredibly well in them, and they prevent Madrid from being encircled or from falling. But at the same time, this is a war of attrition as well. It goes on for 3 years, and the Republican side is basically, even though it's a democracy, it's abandoned by all the liberal democracies, by Britain, by the United States, even by France, which originally has a Popular Front government, whereas Franco is not abandoned by Hitler or by Mussolini. They all sign up to this farcical non-intervention pact, which is observed by everybody except Hitler and Mussolini, who send, if there are 35,000 brigaders, well, there are 70,000 regular Italian army troops. There are 20,000 German troops, mostly from the Luftwaffe, from the Air Force. And so there's an imbalance, and that imbalance grows because the only place that the Republic can get arms from is basically the black market or the Soviet Union, or Mexico is a third option. And Stalin himself loses interest in supplying the Republican side. And so eventually, and the brigades themselves experience this, you know, Franco builds up sufficient firepower to basically drive them back to the sea. And there's a period in 1938, at the beginning of 1938, the end of 1937, where they are. They're driven all the way across to the Mediterranean. And really by then, I think most people know that one of two things is going to happen. Either they're going to lose, or the Second World War is going to break out and the Allies are going to come to their rescue. And in fact, what happens is is the first of those scenarios. They lose, the war is lost on April 1st. 1939, that's 5 months exactly before Hitler invades Poland and the Second World War starts. And so the brigaders who've been pulled out 6 months before that, they fight in this tremendous battle over across the river Ebro in eastern Spain. You know, huge numbers of people die on both sides, huge numbers of brigaders die as well. And it's really an attempt just to keep the war going until it joins up with the Second World War, and it fails. So by that stage, people, you know, are hoping they can resist, but they know that's what they're doing. They're not going to win at that stage. They're just trying to resist until the end. So that's the very sad tale, if you want, of the Republic and of the international brigades in the war.
And that ends the story of the Republic and of the war and of the brigades. But it doesn't, as you go on to demonstrate, it doesn't end the story of the brigaders themselves. I was wondering if you could perhaps speak to the legacy that you described for them. I mean, what did they, the survivors, take from the experience? How did it shape events like the Second World War? And how did that continue to be processed after the war into the 1950s and 60s and down to the present day?
Well, because we're dealing with an international group of people from 60 different countries, we almost get sort of 60 different national stories about what happens. But in the broadest sense, for the brigaders who see what they're doing as an anti-fascist fight, the Second World War is actually just the continuation of that fight. And they actually play a remarkable role in that because they are very active in the resistance in France. The first shootings of Germans in occupied France, for example, are carried out by former brigaders. Anyone who knows Paris and looks at the metro map, at the subway map, will see there's a stop called Colonel Fabien. Well, he was an international brigader who was the first person to shoot a German officer in Paris and is a resistance hero. Likewise, in Italy, many of the partisan armies are led by brigaders. In Yugoslavia especially, all of Marshal Tito's armies are led by international brigaders. And then in the US Army or in the British Army, well, lots of them sign on as well. I have to say, though, they're looked on kind of suspiciously to begin with, and some of them aren't allowed to join because they're communists or because they're considered far too left wing. And but anyway, most of them managed to do some fighting. Obviously, you know, black Americans who had been serving as officers over white troops suddenly found themselves again to be serving as just ordinary soldiers or sailors with no possibility to command or even to use their experience, which was a sorry waste of talent and experience. But the end of World War II sees the defeat of fascism, and that for them is a victory. because there are so many Jews, in fact, and lots of communists who've ended up in camps like Auschwitz, they're also the people who lead the sort of internal resistance in the final days against the German camp guards. So there's this feeling that they've done their bit, that they, you know, that they started off fighting fascism before everybody else realized suddenly, aha, yes, you're right. You know, we do have to fight fascism. And this is one of their points. You know, they, to begin with, were saying fascism has to be fought with arms. And everybody's saying, no, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. And then suddenly, 5 months after the Spanish Civil War, it's like, oh, gosh, you're right. You know, we've got to do this. So in that sense, they feel, you know, vindicated. For what they'd done in Spain. But the Cold War comes along and suddenly many of them in the West are on the wrong side again. They're looked down upon one of the expressions is as premature anti-fascists, which is a strange concept if you think about it. And but then there's another bizarre and, you know, not so wonderful story about what happens to the international brigaders who are from Eastern Europe, in other words, whose countries are behind the Iron Curtain. As many of them are communists, you know, the Russians see them as reliable people to set up the new regimes in Poland and East Germany and Hungary and Bulgaria and Albania and everywhere else, and they get very senior positions. You know, we have prime ministers. There are two effective prime ministers of East Germany, There are lots of ministers, there are lots of generals, especially in Yugoslavia. It seems the entire army is run by brigaders. And of course, their speciality is security, and that also means policing. And behind the Iron Curtain, we know what that means. And so the founders of one of the most infamous secret police forces in the world, which is the German Stasi, the founder is an international brigade general. And for virtually the entire lifetime of the Stasi, it is run by international brigade veterans. So, the story is it is not all wonderful or wondrous in that sense, not at all. You know, some of them become hardcore Stalinists, but then again, in the East, behind the Iron Curtain, some of them also fall victim to purges, precisely because they've been in the international brigade, and therefore they have supposedly been exposed to Trotskyism or to what becomes known as Titoism, because Yugoslavia, Marshal Tito, breaks from the Iron Curtain bloc, from the Soviet bloc, and so anyone who's been hanging out with Yugoslavs is suddenly suspicious. So there are some, you know, ghastly show trials in Czechoslovakia and Hungary, in which, you know, former brigaders, you know, are forced to admit to sins that they never committed and are shot or hung or imprisoned.
That's one of the things that by the end of your book, I was appreciating, which was how a lot of that gets lost. The McCarthy period, they do single out Service of the International Brigades as something to be concerned about. You don't get as much, though, about how this legacy that you see in Eastern Europe of, you know, these people having this long, careers in government, and how so much of that begins or is propelled by their service, you know, in these international brigades in the 1930s, how this has this service has this long impact that we don't appreciate, but it really extends over the course of the remainder of the 20th century.
Yes, I mean, it's absolutely there. I mean, I devote quite a long final chapter to this. But I think it's really, in a way, it's a sketch for someone else to follow up, because this hasn't really been studied as a phenomenon. I mean, there are studies of in East Germany, particularly, which are good. But as a whole, the influence of the brigaders in the communist bloc has not been really been investigated. So, you know, as any historian out there who specializes in all that, I would encourage them to get stuck in. I mean, obviously, in the United States and in Britain, you know, the reactions are different. So these people are they're being watched very carefully by the CIA or by the MI6 in Britain. My favorite examples of ex-brigaders actually are the British, where at one stage you have Jack Jones, who's the head of the Transport and General Workers Union in the 1970s, deemed to be the most powerful man in Britain because he can stop the lorries, he can stop transport, and he does sometimes. And it's a period of strikes and quite a terrible time in British history. And at the same time, another brigader, Alfred Sherman, has become the sort of free market guru to this young female politician up and coming called Margaret Thatcher. And so you have these two, you know, international brigaders on opposite sides of the battle lines in Britain. But I have to say, they would turn up together to the memorial services and the remembrance events, and Alfred Sherman never regretted fighting the international brigades, though he did regret that he had flirted with communism at one stage. But he still thought that, you know, that he'd fought on the right side, which is something that Ronald Reagan in his day said was not true. He said that, you know, that the international brigades, that specifically the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, had fought on the wrong side. Which is a fairly remarkable take.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
So I just finished a short history of Spain from, you know, prehistory to yesterday, which has been quite a challenge and has been immensely sort of satisfying. Certainly filled in, you know, a lot of holes in my knowledge, and I'm about to embark on another book, which will be about General Franco and Francoism, and I'm not entirely sure what shape it will take, but you know, Franco went on to rule as dictator for 36 years. He died in his bed in 1975. So he's very much, you know, the big personality of 20th century Spain, and a remarkable survivor from that group of sort of right-wing dictators who appeared in the 1930s. You know, he's the most successful one, basically. And so I'm intrigued to work out why that was, you know, whether this was a specifically Spanish thing, whether it's down to his personality, whether he just got lucky, you know, how much violence and terror had to do with it. And that's very interesting too.
Well, perhaps when you finish it, we could have you back on the New Books Network to talk about it.
Well, that would be lovely. That would be lovely. In the meantime, if people want to read this book, it's narrative history, so it's full of, you know, interesting stories. I'm not sure one can really do it justice on a podcast without going into all the individual stories, but we really would be here for hours if we had to do that.
Well, maybe we could end by asking you, is there one story in particular that really stood out for you as being that particularly was interesting or was a revelation for you that you want to share?
Well, I mean, there are many of them. I would say there's one incident that really amazes me, which is when a deserter, a Dutch deserter, is caught and asks to be shot because he feels that's the only honorable end to a brigadier's life, and considers that, yes, he has actually done wrong, where clearly he's actually in a state of shell shock. And that sort of speaks to the kind of remarkable idealism that kind of underlied what people were doing. But apart from that, it really is, you know, it's a choral story. It's 35,000 individuals, you know, doing this remarkable thing together. So I think I'll let people read the book and decide for themselves who they find most amazing.
and on that note, thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us, Strauss. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Mark, thank you very much indeed.